I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tee and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today, and thank you.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm Miyohusaki Katema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I try to demystify this program with my good guests. And my guest today is Jamie Graves, who is a Japanese portfolio manager at Skronik Wines, which is a leading wine and spirits importer and distributor based in New York City. He joined us on episode 114 and discussed his very interesting path to getting into the world of sake and technical questions that you'd not normally find answers to. So today, we'll talk about shochu. Jamie recently had an extensive tour to shochu distilleries in Japan. And shochu is yet to be known in the US, but it is as popular as sake in Japan. So we'll discover shochu through Jamie's intriguing stories from the trip and his job at the Skronik. But quickly, before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and now on Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. Now let's start a conversation with Jamie Graves. Hi, Jamie. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
So I'm very excited. So you're back from the trip. So, but for listeners who have not listened to episode 114, please tell us about your background. So like where you're from, why you speak perfect Japanese, why you get into sake and so forth in a short version.
Okay. So I am originally from New York City. I grew up here instead of in the surrounding area in the suburbs. When I finished college, I got a English teaching job in Japan, and pretty quickly got into the food over there. It was the thing I was sort of most intrigued and interested by, and I figured, hey, if I'm going to be living here for a couple of years, I'd really like to learn about as much as I could about the food while I'm here. I was just really interested in it, and then when I lived there for a few years, I kind of worked in restaurants and really worked on being able to speak and read Japanese, it was another thing. I figured if I'm there, I might as well kind of really try to master that as much as I could. I moved back after 5 years, worked in sort of great, authentic, kind of high-end Japanese restaurants here in New York for, it was about 10, 11 years. And then for the past 2 years, like you said, I've been working at this really great wine importer and distributor called Skernick Wines here in New York.
Okay, so, and you are the Japanese portfolio manager at Skernick. So, so Skernick, I really think, you know, to me, if it's labeled, it's imported from Skernick. Okay, I'll buy it, that kind of thing. So, yeah, so does that apply to sake, Japanese sake?
Yes, unfortunately, we don't do any sake directly ourselves quite yet. So, unfortunately, you can't find that that Skernick label on the back of a bottle of sake to sort of guide you to, you know, what you should be buying. That's something I'm kind of working on for the future. And what we're talking about today from the trip was to hopefully meet some great partners. So, we're working on that. But definitely, the back label on wines... you know, the company's been around since 1987 and really started with a focus on quality. And now, you know, you can really get sort of, you know, wine from really any part of the world and all kinds of price points now. But really the initial reputation was built on, you know, stuff that they thought was just really delicious, really great quality. And it sort of slowly expanded from there.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So now you're almost, you're a little bit 2 years with Skernick, mm-hmm. I think. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so how many, last time we spoke, you had about 30 sake breweries to work with. And how many... Now, how many sake breweries and shochu distilleries do you have?
Now, I realized you'd notified me of this question, and I promptly forgot to actually research it. But we've just added a couple more, so I'd say we're about 35, maybe close to 38 different producers right now that we're working with. We've added a couple, and it's about, I was just looking at this before I came, I think it's about 70 or so different, 70 different kinds of sake alone, but then with shochu in there, it's going to get up to about like 80, 85 or so.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like people, Japanese alcohol equals sake, mm-hmm. but shochu is huge.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, when I lived there, I lived there from 2002 to 2007, and that was kind of right in the middle of what is now known as like the second shochu boom. And, you know, just as kind of a guy in your 20s and you're hanging out with other Japanese people that age, that's what everybody was drinking. I mean, I'm talking about kind of the Tokyo area. I mean, before that, shochu had been more kind of a regional southern thing. I mean, it had always been in Tokyo, but suddenly it was like, craft distilleries from southern Japan were suddenly really cool in the Tokyo area, you know, which then spread it to the rest of the country. And I didn't really, you know, I knew we, at the time they were talking about a shochu boom and I knew that was happening, but you know, at the time it was just, you know, it wasn't super pricey. It's actually a little bit cheaper than sake to drink in Japan. So it was, you know, when you're in your 20s and you don't have much money, it was just what we had going out. And I knew there was all these different varieties and stuff. So it's mostly what I drank when I was there.
Right, because I think, by the way, my dad was from Kyushu. That's the mainland of a shochu production, but he even didn't touch it.
Yeah.
I don't think he had a good memory of the quality when he was younger. But now the quality is more craft, like you said. Mm-hmm. And also, good thing about shochu, it's higher in alcohol, like 17, 18 sake, versus shochu is like around 25. So you can dilute it. Like other distilled spirit,
yeah,
ended up being cheaper.
Definitely, it's kind of a hard thing for a lot of Americans to wrap their head around because 25% alcohol, we don't really have many things that are really around that level. So it even comes down to like, you know, how many glasses is it okay for me to drink? Like people are aware of that with like spirits, you know, like, okay, I can have a glass or two of whiskey or wine. You know, they know what pace they can drink at. Shochu is kind of you know, you're just not used to that. So that's another kind of tricky thing for it. But like you said, diluted, it's just the easiest, most delicious thing to drink.
Right.
Dangerously easy.
Right, but I think I have to say, you know, when I go to Japan, I tend to drink sake. And then, at some point, I feel a little tired of sake. Mm-hmm. And I drink shochu because it's so distilled and clean. Mm. It's cleansing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. One of the big talking points that the shochu industry does within Japan, which I think we find very funny from an American perspective. But I even this actually got a laugh. there was an event, I don't know if you were there or not, a couple months ago at the Japanese ambassador's house. They had a big shochu event, and there was some American bartenders, high-end New York City bartenders, who'd been taken on this big shochu tour, kind of similar to what I did. And they were kind of giving a presentation about their tour and about shochu to kind of the general bartending community in New York. And this was at the ambassador's house. And a lot of the, you know, people, the Japanese people were getting speaking, were talking about how healthy shochu is. Mm. And they're like, oh, it's so healthy. And then, you know, these bartenders get up and they're like, well, as we know, it's very healthy, which is kind of funny. We don't think of alcohol as, you know, we inherently just think of it as bad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in Japan and in a lot of the world, it's so just kind of woven into food culture and just kind of everyday culture, that it's sort of, you can sort of say like, well, you know, you wouldn't quit, you know, you wouldn't quit drinking just because you're doing this. So it's like, oh, it's a healthier alternative. So it's lower in sugar, because it's distilled out, and because it's a little bit lower in alcohol, it's, kind of, I need to research this, but it's been called like the lowest calorie, thing you can drink when you're drinking like diluted shochu, because there's no sugar and the alcohol is a little bit lighter than other things. So I find it very easy to drink it. Like the next day you don't really, I mean, people say shochu doesn't give you hangovers. I can say it definitely can give you a hangover. from personal experience, anything can. But it's I find it much easier on your system than a lot of other things.
Mm. Yeah, I still remember Stephen Lyman, who's a shochu expert, who joined me here. He said after drinking, he's switching all alcohol he was consuming to shochu. Mm. In 3 months, he lost like 12 pounds or 15 pounds.
Oh, really?
So that sounds like
shochu diet. I guess you can, it's a thing.
Right. Okay. But do you know, like a, you know, blue zone, like the blue zones mean like people living in that kind of called blue zone in the world have the healthiest lifestyle and diet. And like in Okinawa and Sardinia, the kind of places. And people don't binge on the weekend. Mm-hmm. They small amount of alcohol every day.
Yeah.
And that kind of the key to relax, enjoy, celebrate life. So rather than binging and, you know, like...
Just have a little bit every day kind of thing. Yeah, I've never actually been to Okinawa as well. That's another place I'm really desperate to get to and sort of explore Awamori, which is, you know, shochu's cousin sort of spirit down there.
Yeah. I've never been either.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Japanese person, but yeah. I will eventually. I'm just curious, what are your criteria in selecting breweries and distilleries to work with at Skronik?
Yeah, so like I said, we're kind of exploring that right now. I think it's, I mean, fundamentally, and this is kind of a, this is just kind of a sort of a broad, you know, non-specific way of putting it. But when you meet people and you see the distillery itself or the brewery or whatever, you can get a sense pretty much right away of what kind of people they are and what they're doing, like whether they have a clear sense of what they want to do. And I'd say that's probably the number one thing, that you know, the sake and shochu industry is so traditional, and you know, it's these family businesses that sometimes stretch back hundreds of years or more, and there's many generations. So sometimes when you're just born into it, you know, you don't get a sense of what you want to do for it. So you visit a lot of these places, and you know, they can be making good stuff, but you can really get a sense they don't know, they don't have a larger sense of what, you know, what they're doing out there. And traditionally a lot of these you know, what the business model was for, well, business model, what the, how these places survived and what they were doing, they were just selling locally. You know, there wasn't a sense of, it was just, you're the local maker, it's what local people drink, and you didn't really have many other options. And now, of course, you know, Japan, you can get just about anything there. So these local breweries, some of them are struggling. Some of them are very smart about how they, you know, can kind of differentiate themselves from a lot of the big producers out there, whether that's big shochu producers or other alcohol producers. And some of them are just very much still stuck in this kind of very provincial mentality. There was one producer I visited on this most recent trip, and to me, it was so fascinating. This was very, like, very far west in Kyushu. I think it was like the most western brewery in Kyushu overall. It's like family, very remote. And you got a sense from talking to these guys, it was a really cool old 19th century building. I mean, very evocative, the old wooden beams and everything. And they were making some really interesting stuff, but it was kind of all over the place. Like they didn't have a vision or a focus for what they wanted to do. And we were there tasting shochu, but then they're like, oh, we also make sake. And when I tried it, it was all noticeably sweeter, which I've heard various people say that, you know, Kyushu sake traditionally was sweeter because the cuisine is sweeter down there. Mm. They grow sugar down there, so sugar gets in the sauces, and you need kind of a sweeter sake to stand up to that. And I mentioned to this father and son team that were running this place, like, oh, it's interesting you guys have this kind of local. Like they described their sake as like, oh, well, all our sake is quite dry. And I tasted it. I'm like, this is all much sweeter than normal. And I sort of mentioned like, oh, well, isn't this a Kyushu thing to be sweeter? And they just had no idea.
Interesting.
They kind of made it the same way they'd always made it, but they don't understand the larger context of these things, which, you know, is kind of what I find interesting about my position is even, you know, I don't want to sound arrogant about like instructing them about what this thing is, but they don't understand their context of their sake, even within the world of sake. Like they, I don't think they'd even really been to any big Tokyo exhibitions to know what they're comparing it to. They just kind of kept on doing it. So I actually like those guys quite a bit, but you just get a sense of, it didn't seem like a good partnership just because they don't have a real sense of what they want to do. Like there's,
interesting. So because you have to know what they're doing, even if tradition has to be kept. So that's a very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if you're just selling it locally and that's all you want to do, that's great. But if you're, you know, if you want to start selling it in a big market like Tokyo or New York, you know, we're absolutely flooded with choices here. And then, so, you know, part of my job as a distributor and importer selling things here in New York, I have to be aware of what all the other stuff is available here, what people are expect and what they're used to, and how to find things that are different and unusual that can kind of maybe be different from the stuff available here. Or if it's the same stuff, like, is it at a really good price? Is there something unique about it? So that's kind of, I mean, sort of a long answer to that.
Right.
You know, well, what do I look for?
Yeah. I think that's very important because I know a couple, at least maybe several studies, case studies that the younger generation decided, I'm not going to succeed this old style, you know, sake production, or, and then go to Tokyo, like working for advertising agency or something like that, and realize, wow, what I was doing is so cool.
Yeah.
And they go back, and then with the knowledge of advertising and expressing what they're doing, which is now important, right? So global market and the internet. So those are the things. The packaging is so important to communicate, especially a place like America. So you need the stories to sell.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot to people about this, and this is another exciting thing once we're able to set up doing these things directly is working on labels and things, because it's having worked in restaurants for so long in New York, there's a lot of sake and to a lesser extent shochu, but a lot of sake that comes here that is, they put some kind of really modern or sort of odd-looking label on it. It doesn't really look Japanese anymore. And then you should be able to glance at it and be like, oh, that's clearly from Japan. That's sake or shochu or whatever. But it should be easy enough for an American to look at and recognize. I mean, in my experience, Americans have the hardest time remembering sake names. But if they come back and ask for it, they'll describe the bottle. They'll be like, hey, can you give me the one in the, I had one in the blue bottle, or it was kind of like people, they'll give you these elaborate descriptions, you know, just because they can't remember the name. So it's, the packaging is super important. It has to connect to the story. You shouldn't change it too much, but it needs to be just appealing enough that Americans can either remember the name or, you know, again, it's not efficient, but just describing what it looked like easily.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, Shazam, we don't have to sing the song. Now you can take a picture, maybe short, but it's much easier to clear labeling. Okay, so let's talk about shochu. So first of all, unless you're Shochu 101 for listeners who's not familiar with. So what is shochu?
So shochu is it's Japan's native spirit. It's what they, the Japanese were making before they ever knew what whiskey was or any of these things. They were distilling sort of crops and things that they had at hand. So initially it was very quickly, and I find this an interesting way to think about it, sort of makes sense. So initially it was just distilled sake. It's just, you know, the alcohol they were making in Japan is from rice. They learn what distilling is. It's like, okay, let's just distill this. And from what I've heard, kind of the way that there's all sorts of different types of shochu, like sweet potato and barley and rice are sort of the three main ones, and then all kinds of different little ones. Basically, from what I understand, it was traditionally southern Japan. There's a lot of agriculture down there. And if they had crops left over at the end of the harvest, as a way to preserve them, they would just throw them in with the sake to ferment and then distill it together. And that's how we ended up at all these different types. So it was originally just kind of a rural agricultural preservation technique. And that's how you sort of get sweet potato shochu and barley shochu. And then that sort of evolved into what we have now. And it's gotten very much more refined, very kind of interesting. But it's very agriculturally based, which is something I find really interesting. Whereas sake is... sake, traditionally, look into it, it comes out of like rice merchants. It's like rice merchants who had, they couldn't sell all their rice, not all of them, but many of them were these dealers. And then, oh, well, we have some rice left over. Like, okay, let's make some money out of it and make it into sake. Whereas shochu has much more of an agricultural grounding. It wasn't really rice farmers making sake. It was merchants and things like that. Mm. Whereas shochu was traditionally farmers.
Interesting. Yeah. So that's why you see maybe more clearly the regional aspects, like potato is there, yeah, and barley is there.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's definitely areas of southern Japan. I'm still just dipping my toe into shochu. I'm by no means an expert. But yeah, certain areas, it's like, oh, traditionally it's all barley around here, or it's all sweet potato, and you can taste the difference, particularly with very small producers, if they're making sweet potato, you can taste the difference of where the sweet potatoes were grown, kind of thing. It's very, I think terroir is sometimes overused as a concept of this regionality and things, but with sweet potato shochu, it's amazing how different potatoes grown in different areas can taste, and different types of potatoes too.
Right. Yeah. And so there are two grades, kōtsu, right?
Yeah.
So, and the difference is how it's distilled. So basically, one in a pot versus continuous, like multiple distillation.
So it's interesting. I actually, so the two types, talking about honkaku shochu and what is it? Otsurui? Korui otsurui? And honkaku is, I mean, that's the one you should pay attention to the general listeners out there. Honkaku means something like authentic. It's not just a random word they slap on labels. It's like by law, if you see honkaku on there, it can only be distilled once. By law, you can't distill it really highly, and there's only certain ingredients you can use in there, and you can't add anything to it after it's been distilled. So all the flavorings in there have to be fermented together. So you know you're getting a spirit of a certain quality and made in a certain way if it's a honkaku shochu overall.
Yeah. Right. So that the way it's made, that's why even if it's distilled, you definitely have that barley or potato or rice flavor, which is fascinating.
Yeah, because by law it can only be distilled once, so... Yeah, I mean, you know, this is this thing we hear all the time with vodka is that, you know, oh, it's triple, quadruple distilled. And it's, you know, for those of us who are kind of geeky about alcohol and these things, it's like, well, the more you distill something, the more you're stripping away the character of the base ingredients. Mm. And maybe because shochu was made by farmers who grew these things themselves, you know, maybe they wanted to taste that thing that they'd grown more. So it's traditionally was only distilled once. And so it retains a lot more oils and flavors of that base ingredient. So you can really taste what you've gotten there. And then there's obviously technique about fermenting and distilling and those things. But really, you can taste the ingredient a lot more. It's really, it's what I like a lot about shochu. Yeah.
Okay. So in essence, that's why you like shochu? Like, you know, even compared to sake, what's special about shochu?
Yeah. So, I mean, sake has this real kind of elegance to it. Shochu, I think... God, there's a lot of things about it. I mean, it's just got so much flavor. A lot of those flavors are kind of a little bit, I think, unusual for Americans, particularly sweet potato at first. Some people love it right off the bat. For some Americans, it's just not a flavor that they're used to. Like they don't say that it's, they don't say they dislike it, but they're just kind of like, I don't know how to think about this. The barley stuff I find is much easier for your kind of novice shochu drinker to get into. Because, you know, we all know what grains and barley
taste like. Right. And it's particularly nutty, kind of, you have a taste memory already.
Yeah,
kind of,
right? Exactly.
Mm. Right, but I think once you happen to like potato, it's kind of a quiet taste.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, sweet potato is the most popular style of shochu. It's the one that is, there's more sweet potato made than any other kind overall. And once you get into it, I mean, the differences are so, there's sort of highs and, you know, various expressions and things you get out of sweet potato that are just wild. I mean, I've tasted sweet potato shochu that it tastes like grapes. I mean, it tastes like other things, but you're like, this is so grapey. And then you taste other ones that taste like carrots. Mm-hmm. Like there's, if you make them out of these orange potatoes, it's got the same, what is it, beta carotene in there from carrots. So you literally taste an orange sweet potato and you're like, man, that tastes like carrots. Like the variation you get and sort of the, it's got this sort of haunting quality. Whereas barley is more kind of like, all right, cool. You know, this is, it's this flavor. You get it. It's really delicious. But I find it Sweet potato is shochu is compelling the same way that great wine can be compelling. Like, you just can't put your finger on it as easily.
Mm, so it's a moving target.
Yeah, exactly.
You never stop.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So so let's talk about your trip. So you, when did you go to Kyushu and southern Japan?
I was there in for about 8 days in March. It's the very first time I'd been to southern Japan. People think, I mean, I lived there for 5 years and people are like, oh, why did you never get to Kyushu? And I'm always like, man, I mean, there's so much to explore in Japan in any given area. And I always felt bad or missing out leaving any area that I was in, just because I still felt like there was so much to explore there. So I didn't, Kyushu was almost like a whole other world. I was like, I know if I go down there, it's gonna, you know, it's, I didn't want to do it halfway. I didn't want to just dip my toe in, kind of thing. So yeah, I was there in mid-March for about 8 days and visited 14, I think it was 14 different shochu distilleries, some of which made sake as well. Yeah, and actually one surprise sake brewery at the end too. There was a Japan, I visited Japan's newest sake brewery. It was started about a year ago.
What?
Yeah, it's a shochu distillery that had been making it for a while. And I think it was the younger brother in the family got really into the idea of making sake, and he worked with, there's a great brewery called Toyo Bijin, and he worked with them, I think, for a couple of years, and he just moved back, and they'd built this new kind of boutique brewery on this is on Iki Island, which is very close to Korea. It's almost, there's like one other island in Japan that's closer to Korea, but this is the second closest. And it was on this, like, we were just visiting the shochu distillery. He's like, oh, we got a sake brewery too, if you're interested in that. We drove for like 5 minutes and it was all brand new equipment. Everything was sparkling new, kind of small and boutique. And, you know, it's, to me, it's wild because mostly the story in the sake industry is how things aren't going well. And here's somebody who's literally built a brand new brewery that's trying to make great high-end sake. And it was delicious. It was great.
It's like a silver lining. You know, people just keep saying that sake industry is declining. But it's really hopeful to hear that. Right. So how was the sake? It was good?
It was great. It was delicious. I mean, very, very pretty. You could see that he'd worked at Toyo Bijin. Like that kind of, Toyo Bijin has this very clear, defined, sort of pretty style to it. And you could very much see that that was kind of informing what he was making.
Awesome. So, well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, so the out of, you know, you said 14 distilleries, that's a lot of distilleries. Mm-hmm. So, what was your impression? Like, did you see, like we discussed, micro-regional differences between distilleries that you visited? What was your impression?
Yeah, I think it was kind of all over the place. I mean, there's those sort of regional differences you're talking about. So the first place we went was Kagoshima, which is kind of, I think, probably the most famous for shochu, definitely for sweet potato shochu. It's really famous for that. So we visited, it was really funny. There's a massive producer. The biggest alcohol production facility I've ever been to was our, like, one of our first stops there. And then it's like this campus. I mean, like, we didn't initially know where to go because we're driving up in the car and it's like blocks and blocks of these buildings. And we're like, where do we go to meet them? Like, it's just these big empty buildings. And we're like, where are we going now?
It's like Amazon warehouse kind of thing.
Yeah. And it was huge. And I mean, they had these like robots that were, you know, like packing up the, you know, putting the bottles and putting the cases of shochu on pallets and whatnot. It was just, I'd never seen anything at that scale before. And then literally they surrounded what I think is the tiniest distillery in Kagoshima, Yamato Zakura. You mentioned Tekkan. He actually, that thing you were talking about, working in marketing in Tokyo and then going back to take over his family distillery. He did that, from what I understand. And it was shocking to me because I have Stephen Lyman, who you mentioned. He works there every year and has told me a lot about them. And I've tasted some stuff here in the U.S. You know, it's not available now. Stephen will just hand carry it back, that kind of thing. And then we were there and they're like, oh, maybe we should go say hi to Tekkan. And I was like, what? Like Tekkan, like the guy from Yamazakura? They're like, yeah, it's right over there. And they pointed across the street to this tiny little building. And I was like, wait a minute. One of the biggest places I've ever been and literally right next door is one of the tiniest in all of Kagoshima. It was wild. So to answer your question about regional variation, which, sorry, I got off topic there. I saw a bit sort of moving. I mean, Kagoshima is a lot of sweet potato. Iki Island is really famous for barley shochu. They've got there's sort of an Iki style, it's known, where it's two-thirds barley, one-third rice is sort of the mix. So we went to a few producers on Iki that make it in that style. So they're really well known for their barley shochu there. Other things, yeah, it was kind of all over the place. I didn't really find, I mean, since we weren't visiting, I think, necessarily iconic breweries of each area. It was just sort of, you know, people who were interested in working with us. So it was kind of a just sort of all over the place in terms of what people were making.
Right.
It'd be interesting to do sort of like visit some of the biggest or most well-known ones, which I haven't done yet.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll talk about some of the coolest distilleries Jamie visited on his trip and discover deeper. So please stay with us.
Great.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Taima, and my guest today is Jamie Graves, who is a Japanese portfolio manager at Skarnik Wines, which is a leading wine and spirits importer and distributor based in New York City. So, as we said, let's talk about specific distilleries. Mm-hmm. So, let's start with, you gave me a couple interesting distilleries. Yanagida Shuzo.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think? It's Yanagita.
Yes. So yes, I'd say one thing that was kind of a really interesting part of the trip was we work at Skarnik. We work with five different shochu distilleries. Four of them are from Miyazaki, which I was able to visit all four of those on this trip. And then one is in Saga called Munemasa, which they make Mizu Shochu, which is available here in New York. Kind of an awesome project. Some people we work with, it's sort of meant for the American cocktail market. So I unfortunately didn't have a chance to visit those guys.
Right, well, Jesse, who is the founder, came here and then talked.
Oh, yeah. Definitely Jesse should have been here. Yeah. Jesse Fowlitz, I've known him for years. And unfortunately, I didn't get to visit those guys, but visited these four Miyazaki makers, including Yanagita, you mentioned. And out of all of the people we visited on the trip, it was kind of this tremendous, I don't know if it was a sense of relief, but I was just so impressed that the four people that we work with were by far the foremost impressive on the trip. Like, I thought they were doing the most interesting things. All those things I mentioned at the beginning about what do you look for, these guys all had it. Like, each one is very different, had a very different specific vision for what they want to do. So their styles don't overlap, and they're all passionate, and they're all really excited about what they're doing. So it was just really exciting to see that. So Yanagita specifically, he is just a ball of energy. It's hard to say. I didn't realize how old the guy was. I think he's almost 50, but and most of the other guys, these other three Miyazaki makers, are all in their 30s or so, and you don't even notice it. He's just so like bouncing off the walls and full of energy. He has this. It's again, each of the identities of these places is so distinct. He was an engineer at Xerox for about 10 years before he took over his family distillery. And that really informs everything that he does. He mentioned when we were visiting and talking to him, and he said, yeah, as a kid, he was just obsessed with taking things apart and learning how they work. He said he always had a screwdriver in his pocket when he was a kid, so he could just take things apart and kind of learn how they worked. So you visit him, and it's this kind of small, you know, really like beautiful, tidy family distillery. And he's pointing things out, and as he walks you through, you realize he's custom built most of the distillery himself.
Wow.
So you're in the fermenting room, and he's sort of showing like, yeah, we had some carpenters come in here and like do these wooden walls for us. And you're like, oh, okay. And then he points at a panel on the side that's got a little digital display for the temperature. And he's like, and I built this temperature control system for it. Like he didn't just design, like he designed and built it and installed it himself. And then the same thing with his still, like you know, this was really my first time getting deep into spirits. I still need to learn a lot more about stills and how they work and all these things. So I definitely was a little bit more of an amateur on that level. But he had completely customized his still. And when I visited other producers and sort of mentioned like, oh, do you customize your still at all? And they're like, no. You know, they were, it's the most expensive, most important piece of equipment in their distillery. And they're terrified of, you know, messing with it. So they'll have either an expert come in or someone from the company, if there's something wrong with it, will come and do repairs and whatnot. This guy is completely unafraid to completely just jury-rig his whole thing. And he could do things like switch it from what's called a vacuum still, a low-pressure still, to an atmospheric, closer to a pot still, just with a few adjustments. He can direct the jets in the still so that the spirit can taste really toasty and nutty. Like he does mostly barley shochu, pretty much all barley shochu. And you can taste some from them that are really light and pretty, and then some that are super roasty. And it's not that he's roasted the barley, it's the way he directs the distillate flowing through the still itself. And I've talked to other people about this, other distillers who are, you know, master craftsmen. They're like, oh yeah, we don't. Like he understands the nuts and bolts of the process better than almost anybody. Like on a because he does have this very much engineering scientific background.
It's like not to mention it's like very precision machinery based engineering. He spent 10 years, right?
So yeah,
he can do anything.
Exactly. It's pretty. It was fascinating visiting him, and like everything has its right place. He even designed like the tanks are for the length of his arms. So when they filter, they don't do heavy filtering on some things. He built these custom horsehair filters. It looks like a sieve or something, like a round, you know, wooden kind of ring. And then there's horsehair in the middle that acts as a filter. And he'll just run this over the top of the tanks to give a very light filtering to it. And he said, oh, yeah, it took me years to get these designed and built. Like horsehair picks up oil really well, so it's good for filtering. And then he mentioned like the size of the tanks were designed exactly for the length of his arms. So he can reach across and it's very, very easy. Like he's literally thought about all these things. It's crazy.
So in modern technology is advancing. The very tradition.
Yeah, I mean, because it's very hands-on, but he's doing it in a way that he can still have this very hands-on craftsmanship thing, but he's doing it in like the most efficient way possible, in a way that really produces really great sort of interesting spirits.
Right. So that's Yanagita Shuzo.
Yanagita Shuzo, yeah.
Okay. And so next is Watanabe Shuzojo.
Yes.
Right.
So these guys could not be more different. Like probably in the four that we visited in Miyazaki, I think we visited, it was Yanagita in the morning on one day and then Watanabe in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And the contrast is, it's almost hysterical. Because Watanabe, they specialize in sweet potato shochu. So they're really a working family farm. It's the fourth generation. The Watanabe brothers do it right now. And they mostly just talk about the farming. They talk about how they grow all their own sweet potatoes for it, that they put all this kind of energy into that. And then their facilities, it's almost like a shack by like the side of like it's connected to the family home, and it's, you know, they've got this modern equipment and everything, but it doesn't feel like you're in some kind of like a modern distillery. It literally feels like a barn next to their field.
Wow.
And they even do, I mean, his philosophy, I've never heard of anybody else doing this in shochu. They do spontaneous fermentation. So not using a specific yeast, they literally, when they're fermenting the sweet potatoes and everything together, he just opens up the window next to the tank and lets the air in and just lets it rip.
Wow.
And he pointed out there's a little orange building like just sort of next to the field. And he points out that's where they make tsukemono pickles. It's like a little local producer. And he's like, that's been there about 60 years. And we think we've been trading microbes with the fermentation from those pickles and our shochu for about 60 years.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Because it's literally the wind blows across from that building towards the tanks. And like nobody else really does stuff like that in the shochu world that I've heard of. It's much more controlling it. And these guys are much more like, hey, now that we've made the potatoes, we want to just let it rip. They're very inspired by, they took a trip to Burgundy and were very inspired by kind of winemaking there and sort of had this idea of, yeah, we're, you know, seeing sort of the vineyards in Burgundy and seeing how much pride people took in that. These guys were like,
it's like a wine is made in the yard, vineyard.
Yeah.
Not in the wine, the kind of mindset.
Exactly. These guys very much have that mindset. And he talks about that quite a bit.
Well, I actually saw the website. They're really into making the soil perfectly for as a ground for growing the potatoes. And almost no pesticides or anything.
Yeah. I talked to him about that. They're not able to get 100% organic, I think, because of some fields around them. But their techniques are like absolutely just, I mean, you know, very, very organic, very hands-on. I mean, they talk about the farming primarily. And actually, they're great to follow on Instagram. If you follow, I think it's Watanabe Distillery on Instagram. And, you know, he's very good about posting stuff. And you see them, like, tilling the fields. And you see them going through the whole process. And then when it gets to the fall and, like, September, October, when they start distilling, you get to see them, like, pouring all the, you know, all the potatoes they've been growing all year into these fermenting tanks. And it's one of the best Instagram feeds out there to learn about shochu and sort of see it up front.
Okay, so it's a Watanabe Distillery.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll definitely look up. So, well, that's an interesting contrast. Well, high tech to totally like almost biodynamic approach of
It's very much like farming. An engineering mindset versus like this sort of farmer mindset.
Right. So the next one is Kuroki Honten.
Yes. Kuroki Honten is interesting. They were the biggest of the Miyazaki ones that we visited, not the biggest of the makers. They are kind of the most prominent in Japan. They've got a barley shochu that they make called Naka Naka, which you see everywhere in Japan. Mostly, I mean, not big, big places, but I noticed a lot on this trip because I had my kind of eyes peeled for it. Actually, also, I was there in January, and I had my eyes peeled looking around for these shochu brands. And I noticed Naka Naka, you find in small, like really sort of great little Japanese restaurants, you see that's kind of a great barley shochu option. You see a lot. So they've kind of benefited the most from that shochu boom I was talking about 20 years ago. For whatever reason, Naka Naka really took off. They've got another one called Hyakunen no Kodoku, which is considered, I've been told it's considered one of the three great high-end shochus in Japan. It's aged in it's aged in American oak for a mix of 3 to 5 years, or actually hold a bunch of different mixing, but that's kind of known for these very high-end shochu. Shochu is always considered a very kind of inexpensive spirit, and that was one of the few that sort of broke this image of it just had to be cheap. You could have high-end ones. So they, based on those two, are kind of the most well-known throughout the country. But what I found really interesting about them is a lot of these shochu makers in this boom, they suddenly got big sales and they got a lot of money out of it. And a lot of people just pushed that back into like, all right, cool, let's like double the size of the distillery so we can make more and, you know, make more money, which makes sense. These guys put their money back into quality. So what they did is they bought at that time, I think it was about 18, 20 years ago, they took a lot of the money they were making and bought 43 hectares of local farmland and started, I think it's a separate company, I mean, same parent company, but separate organization from the distillery that just does organic farming for as much of their ingredients as they can do on that. And when I asked him about it, like, oh, this is more cost effective, he's like, no, this is way more expensive. It's much easier to just buy it from somebody else, and cheaper and easier and all these things. But, you know, you get the sense they're in these kind of local areas. And he's like, we felt strongly about this. We want to promote local organic agriculture. You know, it's something we felt strongly about. Like now that they had the money and the means to do so, it's like, well, you know, put your money where your mouth is kind of thing. And they doubled down on that. So they farm a ton of their own ingredients. It's on a bigger scale than the Watanabe brothers. You can sort of see that they've got, I think his Kuroki-san's younger brother, I think, is running that right now. They sort of work side by side with that. And the other thing is they did is they built a second distillery, but not really to create more volume. They built it basically on the top of this mountain to get access to a really beautiful water source. And it's out just in the middle of the woods. I mean, there's like nothing around there. You step out of the car to get there, and it's one of those like idyllic scenes where you suddenly just let out like a sigh of relief, and you're like, oh, I didn't realize how stressed out I was until I like came to this beautiful mountaintop where they built this thing. And that's where they do 100% handmade shochu. They do the koji by hand. There's no real automation up there, and it's a beautiful building. It's kind of this mix of like traditional Japanese architecture with a very kind of beautiful, clean, modern aesthetic, but it looks really good on the mountaintop. And that was really just for quality. They make some really high-end ones there. So that's their Yama series. They all call it Yama something. So Yama Neko, Yamazaru are the brands of shochu made up there. And there's one called Yama Semi that we have available here in the U.S. That's a really great rice shochu. I think one of the prettiest examples of a rice shochu here in the U.S.
Well, that's very promising, right? Like, you know, I think American import of Japanese sake tend to be growing by value, mm-hmm. not rather than volume by volume, because mm-hmm. the quality is going up and people appreciate the higher quality, ready to pay for it. Sounds like it's the same thing happening with the shochu industry.
Yeah, I think it very much parallels what's happening with sake, where there are these really huge producers that, you know, it's super inexpensive and, you know, some of them are quite good. But more so, these smaller ones are really doubling down on quality and kind of interesting things. And there's all kind of new, interesting, crazy things going on with shochu. I was learning about, which actually segues me. I know we're kind of going through the four I visited, to maybe not jump ahead, but Toji Junpei, Kodama Shizo, which is actually an interesting thing. He is doing a lot of interesting things. He's the smallest, excuse me, out of the four.
Just
the
Kodama Jozo.
Kodama Jozo, that's right. He's the smallest out of the four in Miyazaki. It's pretty much him and a few helpers. Junpei Kanemaru is the name of the Toji, the master distiller there. And he's, they don't have the resources to make their own potatoes, but they get them all locally. And he's doing a lot of interesting things. That the thing I was talking about with orange looking sweet potatoes, where the flesh is, you know, basically the color of a carrot. Those taste amazingly like carrots. Huh. And there's this thing going on now, apparently it's just the past few years, where sweet potatoes for shochu, they're not as shelf stable as regular sweet potatoes. You can't just buy it and put it on the supermarket shelf and let it sit there for a bit. Like they basically rot within a couple days.
Oh, because it's more moist?
Higher starch content. Because you want to get starches for sugars for alcohol. So obviously they're maximizing, you know, what you can get out of that. And I think that's what makes them more unstable. Like they'll just basically rot apparently within 3 days. And traditionally what people would do is you get them in and, you know, what you see, unfortunately, I wasn't there during sweet potato season, but when it's sweet potato season in the fall, they come in, first thing you do in the day is sweet potatoes come in and you just wash them and sort of cut out any, you know, undesirable spots, whether hard spots or rotting spots or something, and then, you know, ferment them as quickly as possible. And what I've heard about people doing recently now is actually letting them sit for a little bit longer and letting them get, not rot, but kind of almost start to develop a bit. And this was traditionally nobody would ever do this. And then when you distill those, you get this incredibly distinct lychee quality out of them. It's like very pretty and floral and just absolutely wild. And again, you would never guess that it's made from sweet potatoes, but it's this thing that I guess one distillery started doing a couple years ago. And then, you know, it was against what everybody was doing. The idea was fresh, fresh, fresh. And then these people started doing this. And now this is like very much a micro trend within the shochu industry to
so
do
it's
these
kind
like,
of aging the ingredient.
Yeah. I actually, the word is escaping me of to actually not fermenting, obviously, but sort of, Jukse, the Japanese is coming first.
Right. Jukse. So that's basically it's aging, maturing.
Maturing the potatoes. And then you get this very wildly pretty quality out of it.
Interesting. Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. And lychee.
Yeah, lychee. It's distinctly like everybody smells it or tastes it and they're like, that tastes like lychee. So yeah, his facility is fascinating. Really small, like I said, very traditional, not much new equipment. He does all his koji by hand. Most koji, as I learned on this trip, most koji for shochu is done in what's called a dramu, just a drum. It's a very big kind of machine. I still don't fully understand how they work, but you know, traditionally koji made by hand, you put the mold on the steamed rice, have it in sort of a special room and sort of work it over. But I think because shochu is distilled, they don't need to take as much care. You can still get something really delicious out of it. That being said, there's a lot of if you see a handmade shochu, that's what that means generally, is they made the koji by hand. So 100% of his koji is by hand. And his whole operation just looks like from another time. I mean, a lot of times if you visit breweries or distilleries and you see the shrine in there, like there'll be some kind of it's a very important shrine for making alcohol, and they'll have visited, and his was like this old, it was like made from stone, and it was like behind a bunch of the fermenting tanks like you were, as I was peeking through, I was like, oh, is that where your, you know, local kind of altar is for the, for this thing? He's like, oh yeah. And we're like, it was very old and kind of worn looking. And he's like, I don't know. It's from sometime in the 19th century. We don't know really what it's from. It was just wild. Like visiting him is like stepping back in time. And he's very, but he makes very, these very light, pretty kind of modern styles, those sort of pretty floral type things.
Well, I heard that the originally that this family used to have like five generations of kura, like distillery making sake and the shochu, but it's kind of died and then revived. So it's kind of like really new, but it's very old too.
Yeah, I mean, he's interesting because he's the only guy I've visited who is at one of these small family distilleries who chose it himself. So he comes from a long distilling family. They closed their distillery, I think, in the 80s when he was in like high school or something. And then he went to college, I believe. And when he was thinking about what he wanted to do, he's like, you know what? I want to make shochu. Whereas many of these other people, it's like an obligation from your parents. You know, it's really expected of you. Whereas for him, he actively chose it. And I think he's really apparently beloved within the shochu industry because he made that specific choice. And he's so small and craft and is doing such great things.
Wow. Yeah. So very inspiring. We just only talk about four, but four of them, each of them doing something different and very forward-minded people.
It's funny. They're all really good friends, actually. So they tend to travel as a group when they go for sales. They actually will probably be here in March for Skernik does really big tasting. And they've come for the past 2 years, which is amazing because, you know, for sake, shochu is still so small and they're really interested in the U.S. market. But these four guys actively make the trip from all the way from Miyazaki, which is, you know, very provincial Japan, to come to New York City just for that show. And it's great to have them here. I mean, they're really exciting. And I always try to funnel people their way at this big trade show where there's so many options to taste and do things. And I'm like, you know, it's a minor miracle that we're starting to make these connections now. Like it's so, you know, the distances and the culture is so kind of vastly different. I think it's amazing to be able to.
Thank you, Skarnik. Yeah. Doing that. Thank you, Jamie. So, well, right now though, how is shochu being received in this country, in the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, it's mostly unknown. For the most part, people have heard of soju, Korean soju. They confuse the two. Obviously, they sound quite similar. Korean soju, pretty much what we see here is very mass-produced. I mean, there's a great soju we were just talking about before the, you know, before we started recording here, Toki soju that's made in Brooklyn. But for the most part, it's kind of this big mass-produced stuff. Shochu is, you know, there's some big ones, but like I said, the honkaku ones we're talking about, very small and artisanal. So people are kind of confused as to what it is generally.
Right. Well, the industry too, you know, Japan and Korea, the shochu industry is really targeted more for higher end premium status versus soju. It's more like, you know, to the public kind of.
Yeah.
So that's the orientation, like objective of the whole industry. So that's a big difference.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, shochu does have a very kind of, accessible kind of working class feel to it to me, especially coming from sake. Sake has got this very kind of elite feel. It showed you even the very high end ones, and they're very just kind of, you know, nonsense. I loved Southern Japan. They were so warm and friendly and just direct in the way they talked.
They laid back, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's. Anyway, yeah, so received in the U.S., I think Mizu Shochu actually did a tremendous job making the spirits and cocktail industry here aware of what, you know, what it is as a category, what it is. They were really the first ones to really push it to outside of the Japanese venues and really try to get it to a general market. I've talked to a lot of shochu makers in Japan that, you know, they're all aware of what Mizu's done here. So that's kind of gotten it aware, particularly in New York here, in sort of the spirits and cocktail world. So people are, it's kind of where sake was about 10 years ago, which is people are just starting to learn that it's good and that it's a thing that exists. And I think spirits and cocktail people are always looking for kind of something new, something to, you know, set us to really set them apart, to sort of show like new cool things. And there's so much variety in shochu that I think there's a ton of interest right now. But, you know, again, we haven't really made many of those connections yet.
Right. Well, we have only a few minutes left, but I really want to mention, you know, the recently you co-organized a shochu cocktail competition in New York. So that's kind of like interesting.
Yeah, that was a great thing. I mean, I feel I was more along for the ride for that. The people from Mizu Shochu did a ton with that. We worked with some people from Mutual Trading. And so it was really meant to promote shochu overall. It wasn't about any one specific brand. I mean, we want to make people more aware of it as a thing and all the variation and quality out there. So what was it? Seven different producers we worked with. And yeah, promoted a cocktail competition to American bartenders to come up with an original shochu cocktail that that showcases the spirit itself, that doesn't just overwhelm it.
Right, but the 14 finalists, I got lucky to serve as a judge, but I was blown away how creatively each one of them.
Yeah, I think we were very nervous that a lot that we'd just see like cheesy things like, oh, well, it's a daiquiri, but made with shochu, where it's like, you know, if you were to do that, that would just end up tasting like, you know, just lime and sugar and everything. Whereas people were very good about understanding kind of the lighter touch is better. So to really have that the uniqueness of shochu come through, we were really impressed with the submissions overall. It was pretty hard that, you know, the grand prize was two trips to Japan for the top two cocktails. And there was a ton that didn't make it. We were like, man, we would have loved to, you know, have those people go as well. It was a pretty tough competition. As you know, you were a judge, so it was a pretty tough competition overall.
Right. So I hope you're going to continue the competition from now on every year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, please. And this is my last question. So what do you hope for the future of shochu outside of Japan?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, I mean, I personally just love the stuff. It's kind of funny, I sort of took a break from it for so long. It's what I drank when I was there. And then I came back to the U.S. And I remember when I first came back to the U.S., I was looking for shochu, like all over the place in New York, and I couldn't really find it. You know, there wasn't that much out there. There weren't bars, weren't really serving it at all. And then, so it just kind of got, you know, pushed aside, and I didn't think about it as much. And then when I was at Sakamai, we suddenly had all this shochu, and it was a big part of what we were doing. We had all these shochu, really big fans started showing up. So that got me back into it. And it's kind of, you know, it's something I love personally to drink. I would love to get it more widely known. I mean, the dream is to be able to have it. Honestly, the thing we always talk about is mezcal and how mezcal was like known in the US, or if it was known, it was a joke. It was like this very harsh Mexican spirit. And now it's like, if you're a serious bar, you need, you know, some bottles of mezcal back there. And that's kind of the dream to me of shochu, is to like be able to have it appreciated and represented like very broadly. And I think it has that potential.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's depth and surprises. Each bottle has different magic and stories. So
I know I've encountered some just random people who discover it randomly in Japan. And this was when I was working at restaurants, and it'd be just sort of, you know, very American couples would show up and they're like, what do you have for shochu? I'd be like, oh, how'd you get into it? They're like, oh, we discovered in Japan. It's our favorite thing to drink. And there's not a ton of people like that out there, but there's enough that I think you can, you know, you can build on that.
Right. And you can lose weight in 3 months, 12 pounds.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's healthy. It's everything.
Yeah.
The full package.
Right. All right. So where can we find your update online?
Yes. So I probably Instagram is where I do the most posting. So that's Jamie F. Graves, at Jamie F. Graves on Instagram. And then I write, Skernik has a really great blog on our website, which goes deep into winemakers and spirits makers. And I occasionally will do Japan posts there. I have a really happy about that's sort of an intro to shochu, which is kind of a nice little basic intro to the subject. So you can find that at skernik.com and go to the blog there.
Okay, yeah. Cool. All right. So I hope you come back and talk more about what we do. It sounds like you are discovering so many different things.
Yeah, it's super exciting.
Yeah.
Maybe once we start getting small and interesting things directly here, we can talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, keep me posted.
Cool, definitely.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us, Jamie. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show, suggestions for shows, topics, or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikukatema.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.